Okay, so thank you very much, first of all, to the organizers for inviting, organizing this conference, especially at short notice, and inviting me to speak here, and for getting us all to this wonderful place, which is really one of my favorite physics institutes in the world. So thank you. So I'm going to speak today about some work done in collaboration with a number of collaborators. Joydeep Chakravarti, who is a former student at ICTS, now a postdoc at McGill, Victor Godet, who's a postdoc at ICTS, and two really spectacular students, Priyadarshi and Tunir, whom you should keep an eye out for because they'll be on the postdoc job market in a few months. Okay, so the question that we set out to answer in this set of papers that we put out a couple of months ago was kind of a basic question about De Sitter space. So imagine that you have some space-time that's asymptotically De Sitter. So in the far future, it's De Sitter, although maybe at finite times it was doing something else. And we want to ask two rather basic questions. The first is, what is the right Hilbert space to use for quantum gravity in such a space-time? And the second is that some of us have been working on a program over the past few years trying to understand how quantum gravity localizes information rather differently from quantum field theories, and how does this phenomena that we call the holography of information work in De Sitter space? So these are the two questions I'm going to address in this talk. Before I do that, let me just explain briefly some of the notation that I'll use. So the language I'll use in this talk is the language of wave functionals. So as you know, in a quantum field theory and also in quantum gravity, one can represent states in terms of functionals that assign an amplitude to a configuration of the fields. So in this case, I want to look at functionals that assign an amplitude to a metric on a spatial slice. So whenever you see G in these slides, that always refers to a metric on a spatial slice, and some other configuration of matter fields that in our paper we took to be massive scalars, but in principle could be something else, which I'll denote by chi. Okay, so now the question is, what are the kinds of wave functionals that we should use in a theory of De Sitter quantum gravity? So there's, of course, one wave functional that has attracted a large amount of attention in the literature, and that wave functional is the Euclidean vacuum state. This Euclidean vacuum state in this talk, I'll denote by zero or psi naught. And this is something that one can compute using the Hartle-Hawking no boundary proposal. Alternately, one can also compute this, as we've learned, by computing an ADS partition function and then analytically continuing it in the right way to De Sitter space. So this is a wave function that we know and love and has been studied a lot in the literature. So the question is, what are the other good states in this theory of De Sitter? Now, in a quantum field theory on De Sitter, you would just write down any wave functional subject to the constraints of normalizability, and that would be a valid state in the theory, but that's not something that works in a theory of gravity, and the reason is that you have to respect the diffeomorphism redundancy of the theory. So there are two kinds of diffeomorphisms. One of them are just diffeomorphisms that move points on the spatial slice, and they give rise to a set of constraints on the wave functional that are called the momentum constraints. And then there are the more interesting diffeomorphisms, in a way, that move the slice itself up and down in time, and they give rise to what is called the Hamiltonian constraint on these wave functionals. And the Hamiltonian constraint also goes by the name of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Okay? So the proposed procedure is that we'll solve for the Hilbert space by understanding all solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So that sounds very nice, unless you try to do it, actually. And then when you look at the actual form of the Hamiltonian constraint, you find you have these momentum operators which act as functional derivatives on the wave functional, and then you have, so you have some second order nonlinear functional equation, and that doesn't seem very easy to solve or to find all solutions to. So the trick, and the main technical story here, relies on the fact that in a particular regime, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is so hard and intractable usually, simplifies. And this regime is a regime where the equation is dominated by the cosmological constant, in particular when the cosmological constant is much larger than the spatial Ricci scalar, and it's much larger than other terms in the local energy density in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Now, what is this limit? This limit, in fact, is nothing but the late time limit of De Sitter. You see, this R here is a spatial Ricci scalar, and if you think of what happens at very late times, the spatial Ricci scalar becomes very small in cosmological units. So this limit focuses us on the late time slice of De Sitter, which is what we wanted to do. Now you might ask, why was it good for you to solve the equation in this particular limit? You know, you wanted to solve the equation everywhere. However, notice that if a basic property of quantum mechanics is that we can specify the Hilbert space of the theory at any instant of time, even if that instant is at arbitrarily late times. Remember, this is something that we use a lot in flat space. It goes by the name of asymptotic quantization, where to understand the Hilbert space of the theory, we go all the way to future null infinity, or all the way to past null infinity, and there we can take the full interacting theory and it simplifies and we can quantize it, and that gives us the full out space or the full in space. So that's precisely what I'm trying to do here. Okay, that's why it's sufficient to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in this particular limit. Now, this kind of solution doesn't tell you everything about the theory. It doesn't tell you what happens at finite times, just the way, you know, this asymptotic quantization doesn't tell you what the S matrix is, but it is sufficient to answer one of the questions that I started out by asking, which is what is the Hilbert space of the theory? Okay, so without further ado, let me tell you what the solutions are. I won't derive them for you. You can look at the paper for that. The solutions turn out to take this form, and they're closely related to EDS work done by Laurent Friedel, especially here, and also by these other authors. So the solutions turn out to take the form of a universal phase factor, e to the is, times some functional z, which depends on this g and chi. This s is a divergent universal phase factor. By that I mean in the large volume limit, it diverges, this limit where you go to very late times. And this z, but s is, as I'll say in a minute, is universal in that it doesn't vary from state to state. It's always the same for every state. This z is the thing that controls the different states. And this z has the property that it's diff-invariant. By that I mean diff-invariant with respect to spatial diffs. And it's while invariant up to an anomaly. This anomaly is some local functional of g, and it only exists in even d. And because it's imaginary, if you look at mod of z squared, this is both diff and while invariant. Let me say a little bit about this phase factor. So this phase factor is something that we can compute explicitly. It contains some terms that in fact are familiar from the study of holographic renormalization. This is what it looks like. We can compute it to higher and higher orders. And it comprises some integrals of local densities, but it doesn't depend on the state, as I said. And in particular, because it's in just some overall imaginary factor or some phase factor, when we compute mod of psi squared to compute some physical observables, this factor of e to the is just cancels out, and so I won't have more to say about it here. Okay, so now what about this interesting functional, which is z, which really controls the different states? So as I said, we are interested in this functional z in the limit where the metric has large volume. Okay? But because we have this nice property under Weyl transformations, we can do a Weyl transformation to a frame where the metric is close to the flat metric. And in this Weyl frame, we can take z and we can expand its exponent in a power series in this metric fluctuation h and this matter fluctuation chi. And then it turns out that imposing the conditions that we had in z that came from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, imposing the conditions that z must be diff-invariant and while-invariant up to an anomaly, forces the smearing functions that appear here to obey the same war identities as correlation functions in a CFT. I use the word CFT with some caution because the CFT is not unitary. In fact, as I already said, it has imaginary central charge in even d, and it's not even necessarily local. Okay? But when I say CFT here, I just mean that these functions obey the same war identities as CFT correlation functions. In fact, you might look at this expansion, and our friendly boy is back again, and you might say, this looks familiar. And indeed, it will be familiar to you, to those of you who worked on De Sitter space, because it's well known that the Hartle-Hawking wave functional does have this form. It does have this leading factor e to the is, and then an expansion in this way, and this is something that has been studied. The new element here is that not just the Hartle-Hawking state, not just the Euclidean vacuum, but all states have this form. Okay? And in particular, the interaction terms in the theory do not constrain the precise coefficients or the precise correlation functions that go up here beyond imposing the war identities of conformal invariance. Okay, so that's the new element here. In particular, you could give me any list of correlators that obey mutually the war identities, okay? And you give me such a list of correlators, and I'll put it into my machine, and I'll get a solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. One nice way to think about this is that the space of solutions is like a metaspace of theories. Okay, it's like theory space. So the solution space to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is like the space of all theories. And by theory, I simply mean a list of correlation functions that satisfy the Wadded entities. Now, I should say that not all these solutions, there's some, will immediately give rise to normalizable states. And so the Hilbert space is not really the theory space, but the space of solutions does give you a basis for the Hilbert space, and I'll explain normalizability in a minute. Okay, let me now say something, give you a basis of states which is normalizable. Okay? So let's say, as I said, you could give me any set of coefficients, and the constraints on them are simply that of conformal invariance. So one of the nice things you can do is that you can take one set of coefficients corresponding to the Hartle-Hawking state, the CFT correlators that correspond to the Hartle-Hawking state, and then you can add to it a small admixture of of a different set of CFT correlators. And then you can take the solution to Wheeler-DeWitt that you got by taking this linear combination, and you differentiate it with respect to this parameter. And you see what you get now is the original Hartle-Hawking state, but now multiplied with some smeared product of operators. Let me focus on this last equation for a minute, because this is important. And in fact, this equation gives you a summary of everything I've said so far. And the answer is that we are saying that solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation look like something where you take the Euclidean vacuum, you actinate with some set of field operators at late times. This is what you would have done in a quantum field theory. But then you have to smear it with a very special set of smearing functions. And these smearing functions have to obey the CFT Wadded entities. And this gives you the set of all solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And in fact, this is a summary of everything that I've said so far. Okay, now notice, if you look at this expression for the valid states that I gave you, you will see that there's a sum here, that sum runs over, this kappa is a gravitational coupling constant and runs over different powers of the metric. And you will see here that in general, you'll require an infinite sum. And the reason you require an infinite sum is that the CFT Wadded entities relate lower point correlators to a higher point correlator within insertion of the stress tensor. This is something very physical. Why is it physical? Because every excitation comes together with a gravitational field. And the Wadded entities are basically telling you how to put in the correct gravitational field so as to dress an excitation with the correct gravitational field. Okay? And so you have to have that gravitational field to all orders in the coupling constant. And so it's not surprising that at finite G Newton, you have an infinite series here. However, something simple happens when you focus on the limit where G Newton goes to zero. And in that limit, the Wadded entities do not give rise to a gravitational field for an excitation. And so one can think of non-gravitational states that simply have these excitations of matter fields, but the constraints are still important because the constraints tell you that you can't smear them with any old function. You have to take a function that still has the symmetries of a conformal correlation function. In fact, an important check on our results is that this last form that I have here can be shown to match a previous construction of the Hilbert space by Higuchi that was also analyzed later by many authors, including most recently by Chandrasekharan, Longo, Pennington, and Witten. And so our construction reduces to this older construction in the non-gravitational limit, and it also tells you how to improve it away from the non-gravitational limit. Okay, so now to complete the Hilbert space structure, I have to tell you not only about the space of states, but also how the norm works. In fact, there's no a priori way to decide what the norm is, but we have a natural proposal for the norm. And our proposal is simply that you have these wave functionals which are diff and while invariant. So you square them, you integrate them over the space of all metrics and all matter fields, and you divide by 1 by volume of diff and while. This is a natural and simple proposal. We don't know if it's unique. And of course, one nice advantage of this proposal is we are familiar with these kinds of integrals from our study of string theory. And I'll explain how many of the features that we see in perturbative string theory also appear for these integrals. In particular, this diff and while invariance, volume dividing by volume of diff and while is formal, and the way you need to really deal with it is to fix the gauge of the metric. So the gauge we picked in the paper was to simply fix transverse traceless gauge for the metric. But again, as we know from perturbative string theory, fixing this kind of gauge leaves behind a residual group. This residual group is a subgroup of the diff and while group that leaves this gauge condition invariant. And in higher dimensions, as in d equal to 2, the subgroup parameterizes the global conformal group. And the translations, rotations, and dilatations are realized as usual, but in this gauge, the special conformal transformations need to be improved with a term that depends on the metric. In fact, this feature had been noticed earlier in these papers, but it can now be understood from this perspective. Okay, but the group is still the conformal group. So what do you do about this residual degrees of freedom? Well, to fix the residual transformations, what you need to do is you need to fix the positions of three additional points. In fact, in any dimension, fixing three points is sufficient to fix the conformal group up to an overall SOD minus 1 that's just compact and one can integrate over. And so you can fix three points, maybe to 0, 1, infinity, or something else. And when you do that, you get some finite gauge-fixed expression for the norm. You need to put in the right Gauss determinant, and you can do that, and you'll get some finite gauge-fixed expression for the norm. There's an interesting feature of this expression, which is that, you know, we need to fix the positions of some vertex operators. These vertex operators are the excitations that went on top of the Hartle-Hawking state. And so you need at least two insertions. You need at least two insertions, because when you square the wave functional, you would then get 4. So this is the deep equation that 2 plus 2 is greater than 3. And because of this deep equation, you need at least two excitations on top of the Hartle-Hawking state in order to get a normalizable state. And the vacuum itself does not appear to be normalizable. In fact, the question of defining the norm of the vacuum is the same problem as defining the sphere partition function in string theory with no insertions. It would be nice to understand that better. Okay, in the non-gravitational limit, and in fact, this only works in the non-gravitational limit because of this metric-dependent correction to SCTs that I mentioned, instead of fixing three points, one can also leave these three points unfixed and just divide by the volume of the conformal group. And when you do that, you find that the norm of these non-gravitational states looks like the QFT norm divided by the volume of the conformal group. This is something that, in fact, Higuchi had already noticed, because, you know, these states that he had found were not normalizable in the QFT Hilbert space. They had infinite norm. And so this norm is something that had already been proposed. And so once again, we find that our proposal for the norm reduces in the non-gravitational limit to Higuchi's proposal for the norm. And away from that limit, it gives us corrections. And so this is a check on our results and on our proposal for the norm. OK, so now I've told you about the Hilbert space. Now I have to tell you about what the observables in this setup are. So the natural set of observables we would like to study are what are called cosmological correlators. Cosmological correlators are computed often in quantum field theory by looking on the late time slice, which is of course a sphere, and taking some product of fields and computing their expectation value. However, in a theory of gravity, this is not such a simple thing to do because such a product of fields does not commute with the constraints. So our proposal is that we should think of cosmological correlators in this theory of gravity as gauge-fixed observables. So in particular, you take the set, you fix this transverse traceless gauge that I mentioned, and then you insert this product of fields into the functional integral that I've been describing with the correct Fadiv-Popov determinant, and that gives you a well-defined prescription to compute these cosmological correlators. Okay. So what do we find? Well, we find something rather interesting, which is, remember, I said that there was this residual gauge group which stayed after you had fixed gauge, and this residual gauge group now turns into the set of symmetries of cosmological correlators, okay? So in particular, the set of translations and dilatations act very simply on the set of cosmological correlators. You can have insertions of the metric, of course. I've just put in matter insertions here. And they act in a very simple way. So do rotations. Special conformal transformations also act in a way that's not too complicated, except that they relate cosmological correlators to higher point cosmological correlators because they have this metric dependent term. Okay? So you have these nice symmetries, and the interesting thing is that all the states in the theory display the symmetries of the Hartle-Hawking state. So, you know, we have, all of them are equally beautiful, although we have a lot of diversity of these states. And so we have this beauty in diversity where all the states are equally symmetric, but they're not the same. They have different values of cosmological correlators, okay? But all the cosmological correlators in all states have the same symmetries that they do in the vacuum. Very nice. So now let me go to the last part of what I wanted to say, thank you, which is about the story of holography of information. So a few years ago, in collaboration with Siddharth, Pushkal, and Alok, we argued that if you just analyze carefully the constraints of gravity, then one would conclude that in asymptotically flat space, the all information that was available in all of future null infinity could in fact be extracted from near its past boundary. Similarly, in an asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime, all the information that was available in the bulk could be extracted from a small time band on the boundary. Now, the second statement is a statement that's very familiar to us from ADS-CFT. In fact, one can make a stronger statement, which is that everything is available in a time slice. But to argue for the statement, we didn't invoke ADS-CFT. Rather, the statement follows from an analysis of the gravitational constraints. And we believe this helps us understand why it is that gravitational theories are holographic. So the question we want to ask is, how does this story work in de Sitter space? You see, the reason it's a somewhat puzzling question is because this story is kind of telling you that all the information is available at infinity. But in de Sitter, there's no infinity, right? So how would this story work? So the answer is, in fact, very simple. And in fact, I already gave it to you a few slides ago. The answer is, think of de Sitter space. Okay, and this is the late time slice. If you specify cosmological correlators for me in a little region on this late time slice, that is sufficient to fix them everywhere. Why is it sufficient to fix them everywhere? Because we have this nice symmetry under translations and scalings. And so if you give me the correlators in this little region, I can use translations and scalings to get correlation functions everywhere. Okay? So all the information about all observables can be reduced to observables that are labeled by points in this little region. Notice this is very different from the way things would have worked in a quantum field theory. What this is telling you is if you take two different states in a Hilbert space, and these two different states have cosmological correlators that coincide in some little region, then that means that the cosmological correlators in these two states must coincide everywhere. In a quantum field theory, that's not true. You can take two different states which coincide in this region here, but don't coincide in this region in the middle. And such states are called split states. So this is another argument that you don't have such states in the theory of gravity once you correctly take into account the constraints of the theory. So this tells you how in de Sitter, as in ADS and as in flat space, information is localized unusually in a theory of gravity and differently from a quantum field theory. Okay, an interesting feature of this is that this effect persists in the non-gravitational limit. So, you know, in ADS and flat space, you might have worried that this effect had to do with, you know, measuring some metrics which had to do with some small tails out at infinity. But really, this is an effect that's coming from imposing the constraints. And even if you look at these non-gravitational states that I mentioned a couple of times in the talk, they have the same property in that if you look at cosmological correlators and you restrict them to this little region here, then that's enough to determine them everywhere. Okay? I should say, of course, as I emphasized earlier, these are gauge-fixed operators. So they're labeled by points here. They're not really local operators. But these, you know, if you give me these correlators and they're labeled by points in this region, that's sufficient to determine them everywhere. Okay, now you might say, well, you know, the story is sounding slightly different from ADS and flat space, because in ADS and flat space, the slogan was that all the information was available at infinity, and now you're telling me something different, which is all the information is available in some region R. But in fact, these stories are related, and they're related in the following physical way. You see, in ADS and in flat space, you could have said one way to frame these results would have been that the complement of a bounded region always has all information about the state. And that's a trivial statement because the complement of a bounded region includes the region at infinity. But in de Sitter, every region is a complement of a bounded region. So this little blue region is also the complement of a bounded region, which is the purple region outside, and so is the purple region. And so if you look at it correctly, then you see there's a unity between the story that we had in ADS and in flat space and the story that I'm presenting to you in de Sitter. Okay, so that's in fact all I had to say, and I'm right on time, so I'll just summarize. So, you know, what I told you in this talk is that we had a complete description of the Hilbert space in de Sitter gravity. This description came from solving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in the large volume limit, which is a good thing to do if you only want to understand the Hilbert space, because it's sufficient to solve the equation at asymptotically late times. All solutions take the form e to the is times z, This is some phase factor we can compute explicitly by solving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. This z is diff invariant and while invariant up to an anomaly. Mod of z squared is both diff and while invariant. Importantly, not just the vacuum, which is known to have this form, but all states have to have this form. It's forced in it by the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Interestingly, if you look at cosmological correlators, you have to gauge fix them because, you know, just a product of field operators is not a well-defined operator in a theory of gravity. But I propose some description of cosmological correlators as gauge-fixed observables. This description had the property that cosmological correlators in all states had the same symmetries that they have in the vacuum. In particular, they behave very simply under scalings, rotations, and translations. The special conformal transformations relate cosmological correlators of one order to higher order cosmological correlators. And this gives rise to this beautiful property of the holography of information in DS, which is that specifying these observables, which are labeled by points in the late time slice, in a small region specifies them everywhere. And this is very different from the way things work in a quantum field theory. OK, thank you for your attention, and I'll stop here.
One.
Yeah, I have a comment about the uniqueness of the Hartle-Hawking wave function.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of the uniqueness of it.
Okay.
Now, you seem to say there were different choices. Now, the different choices differ by this.
Different theories.
I would like to say that the different choices really correspond to changing parameters in the Lagrangian.
Yes.
So changing masses or couplings and so
yes.
on. Because these solutions of the world identities, as Hermsegg et al. Showed, they can be put into one-to-one, at least
yes.
infinitesimally, one-to-one correspondence with insertions of local operators.
Yes.
So I think I continue to be a Hartle-Hawking.
Okay, I'll agree.
Believer.
Yeah. I'll agree with you. If you say that, let me just explain. So what Juan is pointing out is that all of these states that we have can all be thought of as Hartle-Hawking wave functions, but for a different theory, not for the standard model, but for some other theory where you change some parameters in the theory. And indeed, one model, as I think you explained to me, one way to think of these results is, you know, maybe in the early universe, the parameters were not the parameters that we see in the standard model. And so, you know, you got some Hartle-Hawking state from there. And now the parameters have changed to become the parameters in the standard model. I hope I'm representing you fairly. And so you can indeed think of all of these states as Hartle-Hawking wave functions, but for a different set of theories, not just for the standard model. Is that fair? That was your point? Thank you.
Mark?
Let's see, I had a couple questions, but maybe the first one. So if I think about the evolution from some late time slice to an even later time slice, is it clear that, or you sort of were assuming that this represented the same Hilbert space, but is there some independent evidence for that?
No. You're asking, do we have a proof of unitarity of
yes.
the theory? No, we do not have a proof of unitarity of the theory. And indeed, in this whole assumption, when you do this asymptotic quantization, you assume that, you know, that gives you the right Hilbert space because you assume the theory is unitary, because it's really an asymptotic analysis. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice, of course, to have an argument which would extend these solutions into the bulk, which is not impossible. It's just much harder to do because, you know, things simplify greatly at asymptotic infinity. And so this is a question which could be answered. You know, can you argue for unitarity, or what are the constraints that unitarity places? But we don't have any independent evidence as of now for unitarity, but it's an interesting question to ask.
Okay. And then maybe one more. If maybe this is related to the last question, but I wanted to understand better. In the non-gravitational limit, you say there's still some constraints.
Yes.
And is it possible to understand some, the is there some unconstrained set of things I can do, and then the constraints would sort of complete those and tell me
no.
what else I have to do?
No, for the following reason, actually. So yeah. indeed, you know, you might have thought that you just write down something unconstrained, and then you just dress it with the gravitational
yeah.
field. Okay, it doesn't work that way. For the following physical argument, which was, in fact, Higuchi's argument. So
mm-hmm.
Higuchi was working in a non-gravitational limit. And his point was, you know, when you take a gauge theory and you switch off the coupling constant, you still need to impose the Gauss law. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we need to do if you take a gauge theory on a sphere. So you still need to make sure that you impose the Gauss law even as you take the non-gravitational limit. And the Gauss law tells you that you don't have, you know, any states which are charged under any of the de Sitter charges. So Higuchi's argument, in fact, was to impose de Sitter invariance, because he said the Gauss law tells you that all your states have to have, you know, no charges under the de Sitter charges. And then you might have thought the only state was the vacuum, because that's the only state that's de Sitter invariant. And so he had this ingenious prescription of doing group averaging to construct all of these other states. But it's not that you can just do something unconstrained and then just dress it in some way with the gravitational constraints to get something. So that's important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess maybe I was thinking, could you do something unconstrained in a spatial region and then dress it not only gravitationally, but with other...
So let me rephrase your question a little bit. You could ask, how do you get back ordinary physics where it looks like these constraints are not important, right? It looks like they should be important globally. Mm. One way to get back ordinary physics, in fact, is to put a heavy excitation in the system or put an observer in the system. In fact, in these recent works on observers in de Sitter, once you put an observer which is heavy enough, then indeed you get a wide space of states which are de Sitter invariant, and a lot of those can look like ordinary QFT excitations about the observer. So once you put in a background, a classical background, that then allows you to generate a lot of states which look like they're unconstrained, although secretly they're constrained, and the observer helps you satisfy the constraints.
I see, thanks.
Okay, I'm afraid. One more question, Andy. The rest has to be on.
In anti-de Sitter space and in flat space, we would not demand that the states are all invariant under diffeomorphisms that are non-trivial at infinity, like rotations, translations, and so on. Now, the boundary of de Sitter space is, of course, rather different than those two cases. But do you think it's logically precluded that there is a formulation of quantum gravity in de Sitter space in which the states transform non-trivially under those symmetries that act non-trivially on the boundary?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. So indeed, it's true that, you know, in ADS and in flat space, you don't mod out by large diffeomorphisms, but only small diffeomorphisms. But in de Sitter space, all diffeomorphisms are small diffeomorphisms. In fact, I mentioned the de Sitter invariance only now. The way we solved this was just by solving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So, you know, all we did was we imposed the constraints that you would get from diffeomorphism invariance solving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. That's how we got these states. And there's a shortcut to get the answer in the non-gravitational limit, which is to impose the Gauss law that I just explained, which says that, you know, the states must be invariant under the de Sitter charges. But that wasn't how we got these states. So if you'd like some way to bypass that, then one has to somehow, I guess, modify the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or do something. I don't know how to do that. So I think it is important. These constraints really are important. You know, maybe one way to do it is, as I said, to puncture de Sitter or put an observer or a background, and then you would get some states that approximately look like they're unconstrained. But I don't know any other way of just forgetting about the constraints.
But not knowing another way is not the same thing as logically precluding it.
Well, sure. So I can't argue for something that I don't know. I can't argue that it's logically precluded. I think this is the straightforward thing to do, to impose the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Maybe there's another way to do it, but I think this is the right thing to do, but we could discuss if there are other possibilities. Did you have something more specific in mind, or?
Not really, though.
Okay, fine.
But it's a big puzzle that's been there for decades, and it doesn't seem like our own universe as it heads into the infinite universe should best be thought of as rotation. The infinite future should be best be thought of as rotationally invariant.
Yeah. I think it does. The answer to your second question is it does, provided you put a heavy classical background. So our universe has a lot of stuff which can serve as a background. So once you do that, then it does look a lot approximately like our universe. So I think that to answer this question of how do you get back, you know, physics that's mundane physics, the answer is you put a heavy observer, put a heavy state, and about this state, it looks like you can do things which are unconstrained. Where you attach something to... Yeah, you could do that. That would be like puncturing de Sitter and putting something which would absorb the constraints. I think that's really the right way to do that, once again, is to think of an observer who's sitting there and kind of absorbing the flux lines. I think a more precise way to do that is to work in this Hilbert space and really think of the observer. The reason I like this description, as opposed to puncturing it, is that it tells you to what approximation you get local algebras. You know, it tells you that you can't, you know, when you puncture things and you just put an observer who's infinitely heavy, that's kind of an idealization. So it's useful to put a physical observer because then you can see that, you know, you get mundane physics up to some accuracy that's set by the energy of the observer and the entropy of the observer. And so I think if you really wanted to think of observers, this is the right way to do it. You think in this Hilbert space and do things precisely.
Okay. Unfortunately, I think I'll cut off the discussion to be continued during the break. We still had a couple of questions, and we had one on Zoom, but I invite everyone to ask questions during the break or on Gathertown tomorrow. And let's thank Suvrat again.